So he's an only child.
He's like poking me like a little kid poking his mom. Hello, me.
I can only assume only children may be a little spoiled and need a lot of attention. That's all I'll say. You're listening to WLRN 91.3 FM.
And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Monday afternoon. William Colby's career is right out of a movie thriller, a paratrooper and commando in World War II, an agent in the OSS, a Cold War spy, and director of the CIA under Nixon and Ford. Colby was certainly an enigma. We're joined now by University of Arkansas history professor Randall Woods. He's written Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. He joins us from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Welcome to you, Professor Woods.
Thank you, Joseph and Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Professor. Tell us, what are the similarities between today's national security controversy and that of 1975, when it was William Colby, who was then director of the CIA, who spilled the family jewels to Congress?
Well, I think some people, I think, believe that what's going on now is unique, and it's certainly not. When Colby became director of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1973, and through his tenure in 1976, that was a period when the so-called family jewels were coming to light. Investigative reporters had turned up stories about assassination plots against foreign leaders, Castro and Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, about the CIA spying on American citizens suspected of having dealings with Russia or China, the CIA penetration of American organizations like the National Student Union. All of this was coming to light and causing a tremendous amount of outcry. There were six different congressional investigations, the most important, significant being the Church Committee. It was a dangerous time for the CIA because at that point American disillusionment with Vietnam, disillusionment with the government, with the Pentagon, and the tendency to demonize the CIA was cresting. And Colby's issue was how much to cooperate with Congress. Ford and Kissinger wanted him to stonewall, but Colby, who was a constitutional lawyer as well as a CIA agent, believed that there ought to be some accountability. And so he confirmed many of the stories that were appearing in the press, and he thought in the process saved the CIA from being abolished.
I just wanted to follow up and ask if you gained any insight into why he risked everything to authorize the release of the classified information.
Well, I think he was trained as a constitutional lawyer, and he did not believe that, despite a life in the clandestine agency world, he did not believe that that CIA was above the law, and if Congress called it into account, it was going to have to respond, short of giving names and specifics. He also, again, the anti-CIA sentiment was so strong at that point that he felt that if he didn't cooperate, that Congress might very well abolish the agency. Mm-hmm.
You call Colby the ultimate subversive. Could he have been James Bond without the looks and without the girls?
Well, he had the girls. He didn't have the looks. He looked like Wally Cox, if you remember the old sort of Casper Milk Toast. But he was not a large man, but very intense, very tough. He was an authentic World War II hero, commando, and Silver Star, and he was a man of iron will. He was, he was sort of a James Bond with the substance, if you will.
You know, going back to him, speaking to Congress and declassifying the information, if he came, what you said, he came to justify illegal and unethical acts as a means to achieve a noble end. So what changed his thinking? You say he said the CIA was not above the law, but prior in his career, it seemed like he thought it was.
That's true. And if he, in my opinion, if he had not been put on the spot, if he had not been caught in that crunch between the White House and Congress, I think he would have never said anything, never leaked anything. When he made the move from being an officer, an operative, to becoming head of the CIA, one of his sons told me it changed him completely. I mean, his perspective, his worldview, and broadened immensely. And he had to think about political and constitutional issues which would never have concerned him as an agent.
How about Colby's childhood and early life? He was an Army brat. Tell us more.
Well, his father had a PhD in English literature and was also a career military man. And his mother was a Roman Catholic from St. Paul. His father converted to Catholicism when he was in college. Rather unusual for a Catholic family. Bill Colby was an only child. But his father, he lived the life of an Army brat. His father was stationed at Benning and Leavenworth. And then when Colby was between the years of 9 and 12, they were in Tientsin, China, when his father was stationed there as part of the American community in China to protect it. And so that had a major impact on the rest of his life. He was bright. His grandfather had been a chemist at Columbia, and Colby went to attended Princeton and enrolled in Columbia Law School when World War II erupted, and he immediately enlisted. His father was wrote about military issues and historical issues. His father was a great fan of unconventional warfare, guerrilla warfare, and Colby picked up some of that from him. And so when the OSS came calling during World War II, Colby he jumped at the chance to become a secret agent, a commando.
Well, he literally jumped at it because he wanted to be
right.
A paratrooper.
He was a paratrooper.
That's right. These people were straight out of Terry and the Pirates. Bill Donovan's operation was vast, and it included analysts and political operatives, but it also included these commandos, of which Colby was one. And there was a great deal of camaraderie, and the parachuting became a kind of symbol of the culture of the commando culture during World War II.
Tell us about his ambitions, what he hoped to accomplish when he joined the OSS.
Well, he was imbued. His family was politically liberal. Colby was a New Deal liberal. He had experienced the Spanish Civil War. He was in France as an exchange student in 1939. So he witnessed the evils of fascism, fascist aggression firsthand. And he believed, you know, like most of it, that he was fighting to save the world from Hitler, from Mussolini, from Japanese imperialism, and fighting for democracy and liberty. He believed those things, and he continued to believe those things after he joined the CIA and became a Cold Warrior.
What was this Jedburgh program?
Jedburgh, yeah, the term Jedburgh, the label Jedburgh was a. It's kind of a magical term which benefited Colby greatly during his life in the CIA. The Jedburghs were a group of OSS commandos who were trained in Scotland at a castle near the Jed River, and the Jedburghs formed into three-man teams that dropped into occupied France just before and after D-Day to link up with French partisans and to unleash partisan guerrilla bands against the Nazis as they retreated across Europe.
Interesting.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or question, you're certainly Welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. And Twitter at Topical Currents.
And why don't we take a break now? It seems like a good time to break. We're speaking with Randall Woods. He's the John A. Cooper Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Arkansas and author and co-author of 10 books, his latest, Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby, and the CIA on today's Topical Currents. And we'll come back and talk some more.
Hi, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
We are the hosts of NPR's Here and Now, now heard Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m.
It's a news magazine designed to keep you up to date with the day's news.
And introduce you to amazing people far from the headlines.
It's Here and Now with Jeremy Hobson, that's me.
And Robin Young.
That's her.
Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m. here on South Florida's NPR news station, 91.3 WLRN.
And NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM.
We're funded by listeners like you and by All Air of South Dade, offering air conditioning solutions and service in Miami-Dade County. For more information or to schedule an appointment, you can simply dial **COOL from your cell phone. That's **2665 and send.
Ever dream of making music but don't know your drum from your bass? Well, there's an app for that. Actually, dozens for your tablet and smartphone.
It almost sounds like you know what you're doing.
You could go around calling yourself a producer or beat maker, right?
Yes, that's right.
Music making apps for non-musical people. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered this afternoon starting at 4 o'clock.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're joined by University of Arkansas history professor Randall Woods. We're discussing his book, Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. Professor, could you tell us more about the background of the OSS and more on Wild Bill Donovan?
The United States was unusual as a nation state in that it never had a full-time intelligence service. The Secret Service fulfilled that role to a certain extent during the Civil War and the First World War. The FBI, but we never had a foreign intelligence service. As ex-President Herbert Hoover said, "Gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail." As World War II approached, William Donovan, a Congressional Medal of Honor winner from World War I and a powerful figure in the Eastern establishment, approached Franklin Roosevelt and convinced him that by this time in 1941, it was clear that we were going to be drawn into the war against Germany and Italy, if not against Japan. Donovan convinced them in this titanic struggle that was on the horizon that we had to have an intelligence service that would spy on the enemy, would analyze information, that would conduct sabotage, that would conduct guerrilla warfare behind enemy lines. And Roosevelt gave his approval. And Donovan, a really amazing man, created this 12,000-person force that was active throughout the world. Some of the most famous Americans, scholars, journalists, public figures, served in the OSS. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Joseph Alsop,
Julia Child.
Julia Child, that's right. And for people who participated in that, it was heady stuff. I mean, it was absolutely. It left a mark on them that they never forgot. And Colby, one of the reasons he subsequently joined the CIA was that he really fell in love with the world of clandestine operations, and it was in his blood.
You said that Colby was a heretic as far as the traditional military was concerned.
That's right.
A prophet for advocates of unconventional warfare. Can you explain that?
Yes, ma'am. Colby went to Vietnam in 59, and in 59 and 62, when Ngo Dinh Diem was still in power, and there was an growing communist insurgency in the South. North Vietnam was communist, potential threat to the South. Colby concentrated on building up self-defense forces in the Central Highlands among the Montagnards, where the Communists were particularly active. His idea was to mold these villages into self-defense forces, and in the act of defending themselves, they would develop a sense of community, self-sufficiency, and would become loyal components of the South Vietnamese political system. Now, he came back to Washington, D.C. The Diem was assassinated in 1963, and was succeeded by a series of military governments. From then on, the military controlled the central government in South Vietnam. Now, when the North Vietnamese began infiltrating troops into the South in 1964, Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara and Dean Rusk began to participate in a series of decisions which led to the escalation of the war. And by 1965, the American military, the Pentagon, under General William Westmoreland, had taken over control of the war, and we fought a conventional war in South Vietnam against a guerrilla enemy. Massive bombing sweeps, which killed millions of thousands of enemy soldiers, but also tens of thousands of civilians. Colby, back in Washington, was head of the Far East Division in the CIA, argued against the militarization of the war. He believed that main force activity, that massive bombing, was counterproductive, that we were alienating the very villagers that we were trying to enlist in our conflict. Colby ran a very successful, for a time, a very successful secret war in Laos, in which the CIA armed some 60,000 Hmong tribesmen who harassed the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Very light American footprint there, just a few Americans. Colby thought that that's the way the war ought to be fought in South Vietnam. And in 1966, with allies in Vietnam and in Washington, he began to win that battle. And in 68, Westmoreland was replaced by Creighton Abrams, and the so-called other war began. From 68 to 72, the emphasis focused on counterinsurgency pacification, winning hearts and minds in the countryside. Colby went to Vietnam in 68 and presided over CORDS, which was this vast American counterinsurgency and pacification program. And it was, he believed that's the way the war ought to have been fought. And it was fairly successful, but by 1972, it was too late. Tet had come and gone. The American people had turned against the war. Nixon and Kissinger had decided to get out. So it was too little, too late.
Well, they turned against the war well before 72. The American people.
No, they did. They absolutely. By that time, for many people, the war was over in 68. After Tet, a lot of people thought that was a decisive defeat, and even moderates in this country, as you point out, Bonnie, had turned against the war by then.
Tell us more about the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and how it compares to today's drone strikes.
Well, I think it's a direct precursor to that. Part of the counterinsurgency pacification program that Colby ran was the Phoenix program, and this was a program to target and either capture or eliminate some 25,000 Viet Cong cadre. These were military political officers operating in the countryside, in the villages of South Vietnam, very effective. They were the heart and soul of the communist insurgency there. Colby believed that CORDS ought to build hospitals and bridges, but also there ought to be a paramilitary component. And so Special Forces commandos and Navy SEALs trained South Vietnamese teams, which went out into the villages, and between 1968 and 1972 killed some 20,000 Viet Cong cadre, or suspected cadre. And now there was a tremendous outcry in the United States over this program. Anti-war forces targeted it. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee held hearings on it. And it is, in many ways, the precursor of the drone program. The only difference is the technology. In both cases, American intelligence gathered information which identified enemy operatives, and then they were targeted for elimination. In Vietnam, in the Phoenix program, the elimination was accomplished through conventional means, squads of armed South Vietnamese guerrillas. In Afghanistan, it's accomplished with drones. But the only difference is the means of elimination.
And did William Colby set up this Phoenix program?
Yes, he did. Yes, it was his idea. It was the military wing, the unconventional warfare wing of counterinsurgency and pacification.
But the decision on who was Viet Cong and should be eliminated was done in the field.
That's right, and it was spotty, to say the least. In some cases, it depended on how corrupt a particular province was. If the province was run honestly and efficiently, it was above board. But in other areas, provincial governors used the Phoenix squads to eliminate their political enemies or to extort money from peaceful landowners.
Again, we're speaking with Professor Randall Woods. His latest book is Shadow Warrior, William Colby and the CIA. If you'd like to join in the conversation, a very complex character William Colby was, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. You can email us, radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents if you have a comment or a question.
After World War II, the CIA was supposed to be, was looked upon more as a peacetime agency. Was it the Cold War that changed that?
Well, the CIA was in 1945, despite Donovan's protest, the Truman administration did away with the OSS, and there was an ongoing debate about whether we should have a peacetime intelligence agency. Opponents called it, argued that we would be creating an American Gestapo. But as you pointed out, with the advent of the Cold War, the Truman administration began to see the need for an intelligence agency. And CIA was created as part of the National Intelligence Act that was passed in 1947. In the aftermath of World War II, there was a good deal of ambivalence. But with the coming of the Cold War and particularly the anti-communist hysteria of the McCarthy era, people came to not only accept the CIA but embrace it. And throughout the 1950s, CIA operatives were heroes, American heroes. It wasn't until the Bay of Pigs that the agency's image became tarnished a bit.
How did the CIA sit with J. Edgar Hoover?
He did his best to block its creation. He believed that the Federal Bureau of Investigation ought to be given control over foreign espionage and intelligence. But the Truman and Eisenhower saw that mixing those two things was most unwise. But Hoover was hostile to the agency throughout his long career.
Again, we're speaking with Professor Randall Woods. His latest book is Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take another short break, and we'll be back and take your calls and your emails. Stay with us.
If you're a business owner and want to raise awareness about your company, sponsoring programs on WLRN can help. Our media research will surprise you. Learn more by calling Michael Payton at 305-350-7978.
Hi, this is Marco Werman calling from the World Program in Boston.
Oh, hello, my friend.
Are you ready to talk about pufferfish and making deadly foods non-deadly? Take a little pull on it and tell us what you're tasting.
If I breathe, you can actually hear me nosing it, right?
That's a nose.
It's the first time, I've got to say, I've heard the trumpet used as a percussion instrument. Join us on The World.
Tune into The World this afternoon starting at 3 o'clock. Partly cloudy today with the highs in the low 90s, winds from the east-northeast at 10 to 15 miles an hour, no rain in the forecast. Partly cloudy this evening with the lows in the low 80s, winds from the southeast at 10 to 15 miles an hour. On Tuesday, partly cloudy, temperatures in the low 90s with just a slight chance of rain. At 1:31, it's 91 degrees.
Get in bed with the arts. During the Summer Theater Fest, South Florida Theater League is giving you the stage to express what the arts mean to you in their traveling bed. Get in bed Thursday, August 15th at 7 p.m. for Mad Cat's show about Isabella Blow at Miami Theater Center in Miami Shores.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper here with Bonnie Berman. We're speaking with Professor Randall Woods from the University of Arkansas. And his latest book is Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. Professor, Colby becomes director in 1973. What were his motives for firing this James Angleton and getting a lot of animosity from Angleton supporters?
Yeah, that's an interesting dialogue. From its inception in 1947 and into the early 1950s, there were two cultures that developed in the CIA. One was the culture of espionage and counter-espionage, counterintelligence, spying, and an attempt to prevent our intelligence from being penetrated by the communists. That's what you typically think of as the CIA. But then there was and Jim Angleton was his world. He was the head of counterintelligence. He was for 25 years he ran overseas intelligence gathering and worked to prevent penetration of the American intelligence community by communist mole. The other world was political warfare, covert operations, unconventional warfare, and that was Colby's world. Colby was in Italy conducting political warfare against the communists there. Then he was in Vietnam. Covert operations was not involved with secrecy as so much as with nation building and the subversion of enemy governments. Colby and Angleton had run-ins periodically throughout their career. The counterintelligence and intelligence people believed that Colby's people were cowboys. They were amateurs. They were and they were going to compromise efforts to gather and analyze intelligence. By the time Colby became director, he was convinced that Angleton had become paranoid. He was absolutely obsessed with the notion that the NKVD had penetrated or was penetrating the CIA. And
Angleton was obsessed.
Angleton was absolutely obsessed with that. And his operation investigated every active CIA officer as a potential mole. And any defectors that the Soviet and East European division recruited were automatically treated by Angleton as moles, as communist agents. When Colby came on the scene, he believed that what Angleton was doing was actually paralyzing the agency's ability to attract defectors and to gain intelligence. So obsessed with Angleton was with a mole. And so after much pulling and tugging, after he became director, Colby fired Angleton, created a powerful enemy from that point on. They were bitter enemies.
And what were the ramifications of that?
Angleton sided with the White House and with Henry Kissinger in the notion that the CIA ought to stonewall and not share any secrets with Congress, any information with Congress. Mm. In 1976, Gerald Ford fired Colby. But Angleton and Colby, even though they were out, held no official position, continued to participate and play prominent role in the debate over how to fight the Cold War. And in this debate, Angleton implied more than once that Colby was a communist agent. That's the reason that the fact that he had shared the family jewels was on its face evidence that he was working for the Kremlin.
Let's take a telephone call or two. Our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. First up, we have Janet. She's in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Janet, but my father was one of the four American pilots who died at the Bay of Pigs. And because of that, I'm very close to the Cuban exile community. And I'm currently researching a lot about the Cuban pilots who went to the Congo in the early to the mid-60s and flew there. Four of them died, along with a couple of CIA people. One was John Merriman. But the problem is the CIA and the State Department still have this time frame classified. Do you know anything about that operation?
No, ma'am, I don't. I do know that as far as the CIA is by definition uncooperative in sharing information. They just don't do it. Family jewels aside, and what Colby was doing was really confirming articles that were appearing in the newspaper. Now, but the Cuban situation is particularly problematic. If not only the CIA, but the State Department, any federal agency, any documents having to do with Cuba, no matter how far back they go, are still classified because there's still a communist regime in Cuba. And I think your topic sounds very interesting, but my advice to you was to talk to as many investigative reporters as you can who might have covered those incidents.
Well, I've talked to a lot of the participants in there. I'm very close to them.
Uh-huh.
And especially the 1964 hostage rescue in Stanleyville.
Uh-huh.
We just run into a problem where this section is declassified. In my own situation, my government told us my father was a mercenary who drowned flying a cargo plane. I was 6 years old at the time, and I spent the next 18 years searching for him, and I finally got Fidel Castro to admit he had kept him all those years in a Havana morgue. So I understand the frustration of getting to the truth.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Tell me, Randall Woods, was it guilt that made Colby sing to Congress? Or?
Well, that's what Kissinger said. But no, it wasn't. There's some who believe that, you know, he died under mysterious circumstances. And,
yeah, we'll get into that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and there's some, that, including one of his sons, who implies that he committed suicide, and that he felt guilt over the Phoenix program. His eldest daughter died in 1972, when he had been out of the country most of the time. She died of natural causes, but the ideas he felt. I found no evidence of that. Colby was a man who had a moral compass, which makes him interesting. Some in the CIA didn't, but he examined a problem from political, tactical angle and the moral angle. And then once he had made a decision, there was no turning back for him. I don't think he felt guilt at all. He cooperated to save the agency.
What were some of the reforms that he brought to the agency while he was director?
Well, he was, as I said, the CIA was, like the FBI, a preserve for white males, and he opened the agency to not open. There were women in the agency, but they occupied certain jobs, and he removed the glass ceiling his principal deputy was a female operative. He invited minorities, so he created that. The agency was one of the problems with the Angleton Colby feud was that the agency was compartmentalized. The left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And Angleton wanted it that way. He didn't trust people within the agency. And Colby thought that was absurd. He believed that there ought to be information sharing across the board. And so he did away with these compartments and created lateral teams in which the heads of various departments met regularly and shared information and cooperated.
So he brought a lot of good to the agency.
Yes, oh yeah, absolutely. He brought it into the modern world.
And when he was fired, what were the reasons they gave at the time? That was Ford?
Well, it was the Ford did not make it. He didn't say Colby had disobeyed orders or was. He just said it was time for a change. And he wanted someone who had, ironically, a closer relationship with Congress. And so the man who replaced Colby was George Herbert Bush, who then was ambassador to China, but who had been a congressman.
And how did he fit into the CIA? And I know this your book's not about him. But...
No, well, I mean, he was, in a sense, ideal for the Ford administration because he was a member of Congress and so had a good deal of credibility there, but he was also, a Republican, a conservative, and a hardline anti-communist. So,
a war hero.
Well, a war hero. So he had credibility politically and in terms of his war record, but he wasn't going to share too much information. So from the Ford administration's perspective, he was an ideal candidate.
You've mentioned Colby's son a couple of times. Tell us about your research and sources for Shadow Warrior.
Okay, sure. There'd been some previous work on Colby, which is good as far as it went, but the family had never cooperated with an author, and it took me a while, but I managed to persuade them that I was going to write a fair and unbiased book about Bill Colby. A lot of historians, a lot of political scientists approach the CIA with a kind of agenda. I mean, a lot of the literature is intended to indict the CIA, to demonize the CIA. And certainly they've done some bad things, but, you know, I convinced them that I would have an open mind about the agency and about Colby. So, his first wife, whom he divorced in 1984, his second wife, his three sons, and his one surviving daughter all gave me terrific cooperation. All of the papers and letters that they had, and their reminiscences about their father and about their husband. So there's that personal dimension that, without which I couldn't have really written a biography because, excuse me, CIA people don't leave papers. You know, they just don't do that. So, and although CIA is secretive, for a variety of reasons, circumstances, several years ago, the CIA historical office produced a 5-volume history of the CIA in Southeast Asia, in Laos and Vietnam. It wasn't published as books, but it was available as a research tool. So those two things were just invaluable for me.
We're speaking with history professor Randall Woods of the University of Arkansas, and his latest book is Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. One more short break, and we'll be back and take more calls. Stay with us.
When a clothing line threw a powwow-themed party complete with headdresses and fake tomahawks, the predictable controversy ensued. But what happened next was not. Paul Frank Industries not only apologized, but reached out to Native American artists for new designs. We'll hear from both sides next time on Tell Me More.
Tune in to Tell Me More this evening at 8 o'clock.
Ted Grossman for Night Train. We're going to honor Tony Bennett, his birthday, with the White House Sessions, Dave Brubeck and Tony Bennett, the only recorded performance together at the Sylvan Theater in Washington, D.C., 1962. Sunday night, 8 p.m. on WLRN, WKWM, WLRN.org.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, we resume our conversation along with Bonnie Berman with Arkansas history professor Randall Woods. And if you're interested, we'll have links to his book, Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA, on both the WLRN.org website and also the Topical Currents Facebook page.
And I think, do you also have this Shadow Warrior by Woods.com, Professor?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay,
sorry.
And that's another website
yes,
for
ma'am,
the book.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
yes.
we'll put that link up also.
Great. Great.
Let's take another telephone call. Our number, if you'd like to chime in, 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Next up, it's Chloe in Miami Beach. Hi there.
Yes. Yes. Good afternoon, Professor. Our book sounds really fascinating. I wanted to ask a question in relation to the famous speech President Eisenhower on his way out of office, beware the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes we might wonder, is there something like a deep state in this country? I was living in Europe when the Soviet Union, you know, collapsed and broke up. And there was a lot of criticism at the time that the CIA had been exaggerating, you know, the power and the strength, and that allowed our military-industrial complex to, you know, continue funding all sorts of arms, the arms race, and that they got it wrong. And I guess my question to you is, do you find, in general, the CIA is truly looking for the best intelligence, or is the agenda to essentially serve whatever short-term agenda of this military-industrial complex? If they get it wrong frequently on big picture things, we end up in these wars.
No, I know. Exactly.
We wonder who are they really providing the best they can provide, or should we still be thinking of Eisenhower's words today?
Well, I think certainly the military-industrial complex is a reality. And certainly, it is a powerful force in Congress. It's a powerful economic force, and Eisenhower was right to warn against it. Ironically, the CIA CIA is only one of a number of intelligence agencies. The Pentagon has its own. The CIA has continually advised the Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon administrations that the war in Vietnam was that it shouldn't be fought, that it was being fought the wrong way, that we were losing. I have found it to be among, which made it very unpopular with the White House. But the analytical wing of the CIA has a very good record. Now, again, there are two cultures in the CIA, one typified by Angleton, which were true believers, very, very, very conservative, hardline, cold warriors. But there were also political liberals, typified by Colby. And after he left office, Colby was adamant in arguing against exaggeration of Soviet and Chinese capabilities. He was a fan of the Test Ban Treaty. He was a fan of SALT I and SALT II. And in speeches in newspapers, continually really took up Eisenhower's refrain, warning against. He thought that a military-industrial complex was necessary, but it ought to be taken with a grain of salt.
Well, why don't we move along to his mysterious death? Tell us about that. He certainly had a lot of enemies.
He did, and if you think about it, there were, you know, he was Director of Central Intelligence when the U.S. was forced out of Vietnam in 1975. And the agency was forced to leave behind a lot of people, a lot of South Vietnamese who had worked for the CIA and collaborated with them, and they many of them were imprisoned or killed. Their relatives were obviously upset.
Why weren't they taken care of?
Well, they got out because the collapse was so sudden, and they got out. The Pentagon and the Marines and the CIA got out some 90,000 South Vietnamese, but it's estimated that as a million South Vietnamese at one point worked for the Americans. Now you could argue that we should have seen the handwriting on the wall earlier, which I think is probably true.
Mm-hmm.
And begun evacuation earlier, but we didn't. And he had enemies, you know, in Indonesia in 1965. Colby helped instigate a civil war there that eventually took the lives of 300,000 people. So indeed, he was involved in the operations in Australia after he left the CIA. At any rate, he and his second wife had a cottage on the Chesapeake Bay. Colby had a sailboat. He was fond of sailing, sailed all his life. His wife was in Houston visiting his mother, and he called her one evening, said he'd been working on his sailboat all day. He was going to go to bed early. The neighbors saw him shortly thereafter watering his lawn, and he disappeared. Several days later, a canoe which he had moored in front of his house was found full of sand out on the Chesapeake Bay on a spit of sand. And then a week later, his body washed ashore. The CIA in these situations are always first on the scene. They were there for several days before they allowed the sheriff's office and the coroner to move in. The first ruling was that he'd died of unknown causes, and subsequently the coroner ruled that he'd drowned. But you know, this is a 76-year-old man. He's out canoeing after dark in the house. His computer was still on. His meal was half eaten. The door was open. His wallet was on the table. I don't know if he was murdered, but I certainly say that he died under suspicious circumstances.
You talk about his son thinking that Colby committed suicide, but being a warrior type, wouldn't you think that he would leave a note and blow his brains out or something?
I don't think suicide ever crossed his mind. I don't think he was suicidal. His wife said he'd been on a trip around the world, been to Tibet. He'd gotten back. She said he was in a great mood. He was madly in love with his second wife. I can't see it. Carl Colby, the son who did a film on it, you know, argues, you know, I think he's angry that over the fact that his father divorced his mother, and I think that he feels that the family was neglected. There's certainly some of his siblings certainly don't feel that way. They feel quite differently, and actually have publicly stated that in their view that their father did not and could not have committed suicide.
And did you form an opinion through all your research?
Well, I formed an opinion. I think he was killed, but I just don't know who did it. I don't know. You know, there are all kinds of theories, and until you would have to have access to the CIA investigation of his death make any conclusive arrangements. There was a journalist named Zalen Grant who's still around, who knew Colby in Vietnam and was in Paris. And as soon as he heard of Colby's death, and the notion that he drowned or committed, he smelled something, and he came back and he wrote a couple of articles on Colby's death and disappearance, and he believed that it was mysterious, mm-hmm. that there was a third agent.
Well, Professor Randall Woods from the University of Arkansas, we want to thank you so much for being with us today. The name of the book is Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
And that's today's program. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Michael Stock. Paul Leary is online producer. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. You can listen to or download free audio archives at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is our At Your Service Pet Care program with veterinarian Dr. Ian Kupke. Do you have an aggressive pet? And to the calendar, all literary. On this day in 1859, 154 years ago, the birth of author Catherine Lee Bates in Falmouth, Massachusetts. She wrote the poem America the Beautiful. Of course, it was made into a hymn by Samuel Ward in 1882. And on this day in 1915, 98 years ago, writer Somerset Maugham publishes the semi-autobiographical novel of Human Bondage. The 1934 film version starred Betty Davis and Leslie Howard and made Davis a star. And one more. On this day, 1931, 82 years ago, the birth of writer William Goldman in Highland Park, Illinois. He wrote the screenplay for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, as well as All the President's Men. We leave with this thought from William Goldman, who also wrote screenplays for The Stepford Wives and Marathon Man. Quote from Goldman, "Life isn't fair. It's just fairer than death. That's all." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Next, get into the here and now from NPR News.